There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
All right, Kolchak, Night Stalker, coming down in 3, 2, and 1.
Richard Serrant's Strange Planet, following the truth wherever it leads, exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites, revealing the highest strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality, coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Recognize that? I hope so. That's the theme from The Night Stalker, television series that aired on ABC back in 1974. Well, the fall of 74 just lasted a season, 20 episodes, and of course the series followed independent news service reporter Carl Kolchak, played by Darren McGavin, an investigator of journalist who would delve into these strange crimes, murders, where the perpetrator was usually something on the supernatural order. And this, of course, followed in the footsteps of the wildly successful movie of the week back in 1972, The Night Stalker, followed by The Night Strangler a year later in 1973. I was a huge fan of the movie of the week. It traumatized me, I'll tell you that much. And then, of course, later the TV series. And we're going to delve into that over the next 40 minutes or so. And Kendall R. Phillips is here. He's a university professor, teaches communications and rhetorical studies at Syracuse, and he's also a podcaster. We'll tell you a little bit about that later as well. And just about ready to release a brand new book called Kolchak, The Night Stalker, part of the TV Milestone series, and it'll be issued in paperback, just in a few days, actually. Kendall Phillips, welcome aboard. How are you?
Hi, Richard. So great to be here and love talking about Kolchak. And I particularly love people who remember when it very first came out. I'm a little bit younger, so I caught it later, but it's so great to hear people having memories of that original 1972 TV movie.
Well, because in the 70s, it was a big deal. The movie of the week was a huge deal. I mean, that was, families would gather around the television. I was one of five children. We couldn't afford, my family to take us to the movies. So that movie of the week was a big deal. And back then, they really spent a lot of time promoting it. I mean, I remember watching the promo for that movie. And everyone, of course, was talking about it. Oh, did you see the movie of the week? It's going to be about a vampire in Las Vegas. There was such anticipation. They don't do that anymore, of course. That movie of the week, that set all kind of rating records, didn't it?
It was the most watched television movie up to that point and kept that title for quite some years. So it really was a phenomena. And the other interesting thing is, if you go back and look, the ratings grew sort of every half hour, every quarter hour as it went on. So not only were people anticipating it, but there seems to be that people were getting on the phone and calling their Aunt Millie and saying, oh my goodness, have you seen this show? You got to turn this on. This movie is wild. So it really did capture a moment in American culture, unlike a lot of other TV movies. I mean, it certainly was part of that tradition of the ABC movie of the week, but Night Stalker really captured the imagination.
Right. And again, Carl Kolchak, working for this Chicago Newswire service called Independent News, and he's investigating a series of murders in Las Vegas. And I guess he befriends or is a girlfriend with a sort of a Las Vegas, I don't know if she was a showgirl played by Carol Lindley. And she gets him involved in learning about sort of vampire lore. And the rest, as they say, is history. But I know you're writing primarily about the series, but that movie of the week really started it all. And the casting of the vampire, Janos Skorzeny, played by Barry Atwater. What a brilliant bit of casting. Is there any backstory there how Barry became attached to that movie?
Yeah, Barry, so Dan Curtis was the producer, and folks might not know the name, but Dan Curtis had previously kind of his claim to fame. He had produced a long-running, very popular soap opera called Dark Shadows. And Dark Shadows is probably the show that should get the most credit for really pushing horror into television. You know, there certainly had been things like The Outer Limits and The Twilight Zone, and there'd been sort of spoof shows like The Munsters and The Addams Family. But Dark Shadows was one of the first, at least in American television, to take, gothic horror themes, vampires and ghosts and things, and turn that into a serialized show. And so Dan Curtis comes on board with ABC to produce The Night Stalker. And one of Dan Curtis's kind of regular themes was he liked to reach out and bring in well-established character actors. He really valued the character actor who could come in and bring so much life to a character, pardon the pun, for the vampire. And certainly Barry Atwater, who really has no lines, captures the imagination. He really is the embodiment of a vampire in that first TV movie.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he appeared in an episode, at least one episode of The Twilight Zone, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah, he had been in The Twilight Zone. He had been, of course, on Star Trek. Some people would probably know him from that. And he had had appearances in Night Gallery and The Outer Limits. So he was not unfamiliar to fans of science fiction. So, and again, I think that's one of the things Dan Curtis was very good at, picking cast not just based on their acting talent, but kind of on their familiarity for the TV audience. And so, you know, that's certainly the case for Barry Atwater. Also the case for Darren McGavin. You know, Darren McGavin's first major TV role was as a crime-fighting newspaper photographer in a very early, like, 1960s series based on Flash Gun Kelly, who was a newspaper reporter who fought crime. And so Darren McGavin kind of had embodied that hard-boiled reporter and also a kind of hard-boiled investigator and private investigator. And so, again, for TV audiences in 1972, seeing Barry Atwater in a science fiction role felt comfortable, and seeing Darren McGavin as an investigator felt absolutely comfortable.
And the teleplay by Richard Matheson, of course, who, along with Rod Serling and a couple of others, it was kind of a core group of four of them, but Matheson wrote some of the great Twilight episodes. So what a tremendous asset to bring him on board to write the screenplay.
No, they were really, it's really, I think, you know, honestly, and I do talk about this a little bit in the book, the Night Stalker really has this kind of perfect triangulation. The basis, for folks who are maybe not that familiar with the series, the basis of it was an unpublished novel by a guy named Jeff Rice, who had written a book called The Kolchak Papers that was very much the plot of the first film, a newspaper reporter investigating a series of murders, becomes convinced that the murderer is a vampire, and so we end up with this kind of vampire hunt. The novel didn't ever get traction, but ABC was interested. So they bring in Richard Matheson, who had written I Am Legend. He had written The Incredible Shrinking Man, had written for The Twilight Zone. You bring in Dan Curtis, who had this track record of not only Dark Shadows, but producing a lot of TV movies based on sort of classic gothic characters like Dracula and Jekyll and Hyde. And then you get Darren McGavin. And so that talent pool is like the perfect storm for turning a traditional gothic vampire story into something that was very, very contemporary for 1970 audiences.
And I mean, there's so much to unpack here. There's the, let's talk about Kolchak and Darren McGavin. The trademark iconic straw hat, the seersucker suit worn with sneakers, that cheap Instamatic camera that he wore with a little strap around his wrist, of course the portable tape recorder. How much of that was the book, the character in the book, and how much of that was Darren McGavin's creation?
You know, Darren McGavin had a remarkable amount of influence on the character. Certainly, you know, the book was, and Jeff Rice had actually worked in a newspaper office in Las Vegas, so he knew the reality of investigative reporting. And so the book was very good about grounding the hunt for a vampire in the real work that an investigative reporter would do. So the book gets a lot of credit for that. But when Darren McGavin came on, the original plan was to have his character wearing Hawaiian shirts and khaki pants, because that's what the screenwriters and the costume department thought a Las Vegas reporter would wear. But McGavin really centered on a line of dialogue in the original TV movie where Kolchak is kind of reminiscing about his successful career in New York City as a New York City reporter. Things didn't go well, and he ends up, you know, kind of falling down the career ladder until he ends up in Las Vegas. And so McGavin was the one who said, what would a newspaper reporter from New York be wearing? Because in his mind, everything about Carl Kolchak was wanting to get back to New York back to a big paper like the Times or the Wall Street Journal, back to kind of Pulitzer Prize winning level investigative reporting. And so he was the person who really pushed for this seersucker suit, the straw hat, because he thought that's what a New York City reporter in the early 1970s, late 1960s would be wearing.
The portable tape recorder, which is almost a character of its own, because he's constantly dictating these, you know, wonderful monologues. And in the movie, that, you know, the final scene, Kolchak is in this sleazy hotel room, and he's trying to explain that if anyone tries to verify the events, you know, that of what happened in his reportage, they're going to find all the witnesses have either left town, or they're not talking, or they're dead. And you know, he talks about the vampire and all his victims have been cremated, destroying any further ability to investigate the matter, and so forth. But that device kind of mirrors Bram Stoker, because he used sort of, well, you know, the book Dracula. He uses multiple first person narration, and it's, you know, it's journals and records and documents and that sort of thing. That's how Dracula is told. Was that a deliberate sort of homage to Bram Stoker?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of those early Gothic novels, certainly Dracula, but even earlier novels like The Monk and The Castle Otranto, which are probably two of the first kind of Gothic novels, at least in English, use that device of what's often called an epistolary novel, where the novel is told through a series of letters. And the great thing about that, from kind of the perspective of Gothic, is if I'm telling you the story of a ghost, I can say, I think I saw a ghost, or it looked like a ghost. I can describe it, while the reader is always kind of not quite certain if it really was a ghost or if it's just what I thought I saw. And so Matheson and the creators of the Night Stalker certainly borrow from that Gothic tradition of everything is kind of recounted by Carl. Like, the most episodes begin with Carl saying, I'm going to tell you this amazing story. And you go through the story. And at the end, we've got Carl again with his tape recorder saying, and so those are the events. And of course, all the evidence is gone. But the other homage that I think really probably resonated with you know, TV audiences in the 1970s was film noir and TV noir. So think about all those great, you know, Casablanca and those movies where you get the hard-boiled private detective kind of sitting at the bar saying, let me tell you what happened, right? Or kind of giving us the blow-by-blow narrative. So I think one of the great things about The Night Stalker, both the TV movies and later the series, was it was able to take really traditional 18th and 19th century Gothic and kind of blend it in with 1940s and 1950s kind of crime and film noir, and then transport all of that in the 1970s. And as much as that sounds like a time travel mashed potato soup, it actually ends up working quite perfectly.
Right. And taking all of those mythical creatures and supernatural characters and monsters from, you know, merry old England and castles in England, and transporting them to, well, what was then modern day Chicago.
Which I have to say, I think for me, that is probably, particularly for the first movie, which really was the event that brought Carl Kolchak into kind of popular imagination, that 1972 Night Stalker. I really think that one of the things that movie did so well was it took, exactly as you said, that traditional Gothic vampire, which, you know, in the early 1970s, people would have been thinking of like Hammer horror films, you know, Christopher Lee or Vincent Price or Bela Lugosi with a long cape. But they took the vampire and they really put him in 1970s Las Vegas, because he has to rent a house. He has to buy a car. He has to dress like a normal person. He has to go around casinos looking for victims. And when they find a dead body, the police come, there's an autopsy, like all those regular things that are part of real life 1970s America were in that show. And so it really did take the magical creature from Victorian England and put it very much live, flesh and blood, in 1970s Las Vegas. And I think for a lot of audiences, that was very unsettling.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I can vouch for that. And just getting back to that movie of the week for one moment, and then we'll move on to the series and the wonderful cast. aside from Darren McGavin, the Simon Oaklands and the, we'll get into them in a second, but that was so successful. And again, this was a made-for-TV movie of the week. Wasn't it then over in Europe, I don't know if it was Japan or France, they re-released it theatrically?
Yes, it did get a theatrical release in some countries and was, again, I think really when you look at even mainstream horror in America in the early 1970s, if the Night Stalker had just added a little more blood and a few more obscenities and a little bit of nudity, it could have been a classic film right alongside some of those other great films of the early 1970s, like The Last House on the Left, like Straw Dogs, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, it was an incredibly high quality film, but obviously kind of shaved down a little bit and made acceptable for American audiences. But I think, you know, the quality of that film undoubtedly, that TV movie, is what opened up the door, not only for Carl Kolchak, but for all of the kind of Monster Hunter TV series that would follow.
Right. Well, we should mention The X-Files, right? And Chris Carter and how that movie and then later the series impacted him in creating The X-Files.
Yeah, when you talk about the legacy of The Night Stalker, this is where I think any of your listeners who might be saying, why do I care about a 1970s TV show? This is where hopefully their ears will perk out, because when, you know, Chris Carter is trying to develop the X-Files, he's very explicitly saying, this is like Kolchak, the Night Stalker. Eric Kripke, who had the very, very long-running series Supernatural, his first idea for Supernatural were two young men who were reporters for an internet blog. And then he realized that was just a ripoff of Carl Kolchak. In fact, when Twin Peaks is first brought to the network, the ABC is interested in Twin Peaks specifically because the executive said maybe we could recapture the magic of the Night Stalker. So all these series, Buffy the Vampire Slayers, Friday the 13th, the series, all those horror series of that period of the kind of late 80s into the 90s, all of them, the creators are trying to recapture the magic of that first Carl Kolchak Night Stalker TV movie.
And Carter wanted McGavin to appear as Kolchak back in the X-Files, right?
He did. And so McGavin appears in a kind of variation on Kolchak, but he does not appear as the character. But it's clearly an homage because it is undoubtedly Carl Kolchak who is the grandfather of Mulder and Scully and Buffy and all the rest of them. So there is no doubt his influence is big. And in fact, when they tried to reboot The Night Stalker in 2005, in a fairly unsuccessful attempt to revisit the series using a different younger actor, one of the homages they gave to McGavin was they digitally put the original character in one of the scenes. But alas, that was as close as it got to the glory of the original series.
Now, we're just going to take a time out here in a moment, but very quickly, the other, iconic prop, if you will, from the movie and the series was that Kolchak's 1966 yellow convertible Ford Mustang. Any idea whatever happened to that vehicle? I would love to have that.
I do not, but if anybody knows, they can. I will say there's a very rabid Kolchak fan community, and there are endless discussions about the exact make and model of the car, the exact type of camera he used. So I'm sure one of those folks, Mark Dowidziak, who is the undisputed king of Carl Kolchak, Mark probably does know where that Mustang is.
All right. We'll take a time out and come back and continue to discuss Carl Kolchak and Night Stalker with Kendall Phillips. Stay with us.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
What are you doing here? How did you get in here?
Yeah, well, if I told you, Captain, you'd slap me in irons.
Slap you in irons? I'll have you keel-hauled for this.
Well, Captain, you seem to be fond of living in the past, so perhaps you'd be interested in knowing that there is a werewolf on board.
Really?
Really?
Article 22, Revised Maritime Code. Should any passenger or passengers exhibit, in the captain's opinion, an unbalanced state of mind, the captain may order that such passenger be put
to sleep. Yes, I know.
I won't deny we've had trouble. My officers concur with me that we've had a psychotic killer on board.
A psychotic killer? What about the drugs missing from the infirmary?
The man may have had a serious drug problem, but since the attacks have stopped, obviously one of three things has happened. The man fell overboard, the man committed suicide, or the man suffered serious injuries and crawled away to the bowels of the ship to die.
Or the thing is still alive and waiting for the moon to rise.
The moon?
The moon, the full moon! Check your nautical charts, Captain, for the exact time.
Have Mr. Hallam come up here with the security party, please.
Listen, you've seen the photographs that I took. Did you see a psychotic killer in that? All right, I will address you in terms you will understand. You will understand and comply with the following orders. All security personnel are to be equipped with silver bullets. Those silver bullets are to be blessed by a priest, not in English, but in Latin. Furthermore, sir, before moonrise, all passengers and personnel are to be restricted to their cabins with the doors bolted and locked. End of orders, sir.
There you go. Darren McGavin, Carl Kolchak, and that is from the Night Stalker TV series, which ran from the fall of 1974 to March of 1975, 20 episodes. That's the werewolf, of course, a werewolf on board a cruise. And Kendall Phillips is with us, and he's an expert in all things Carl Kolchak and the Night Stalker. He has a new book out called Kolchak, the Night Stalker. That's part of the TV Milestone series. Actually, it's just going to be released in August 16th. So let's spend a few moments talking about this amazing cast. Of course, we talked about Darren McGavin as Kolchak. Simon Oakland, who played Kolchak's rather constantly agitated, long-suffering editor, Tony Vincenzo. Talk to me a little bit about, I guess we're going to play a little bit of word association. I'll throw out some names and you give me your thoughts on Simon Oakland and his character, Tony Vincenzo.
I mean, undoubtedly the perfect actor for that role. As you said, you know, Tony was always annoyed. And in fact, one of the things that's funny about the series is after 20 episodes of Carl showing up and saying, it's a vampire, it's a demon, it's a lizard creature, Tony's always exasperated. At some point, you think Tony would kind of get the idea that Carl is always going to come up with some bizarre explanation. But undoubtedly, you know, again, one of the great things about most horror narratives, right, whether it's TV or film, is that you balance the really scary bits with the funny bits. And undoubtedly for the Kolchak, the Night Stalker, the series, as well as for the two TV movies, the comedy was often driven by McGavin and Simon Oakland, and their battles of will and sniping at each other are legendary. Folks that don't recognize Simon Oakland from the series will probably remember him from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, where he actually has kind of the last word in Psycho. He plays the psychiatrist who comes at the very end of Psycho to offer this very long-winded explanation of what Norman Bates was up to. Oakland had also been on The Twilight Zone and Bonanza. So again, he was a much beloved character actor, but he absolutely was the perfect, irate, exasperated senior editor dealing with a reporter whose theories were often completely out of this world.
And another one of Kolchak's colleagues at INS, the Independent News Service in Chicago, was Ron Updike, who Kolchak constantly referred to as Uptight. He was this San Francisco native And it was just like the total opposite, where Kolchak was kind of rumpled and frumpy. Updike was always smartly dressed and hobnobbing with Chicago's elite. That was played by, was it Jack Greenidge?
That's exactly right. And you know, Jack Greenidge had actually had a very impressive film career. He had been in King Creole with Elvis Presley, of all things. He had been in Rebel Without a Cause. He'd also been in some Twilight Zone episodes. But he was, again, that very perfect, uppity, uptight, very snobby, very sophisticated reporter, and the exact opposite of Carl's gritty, always rumpled, always a little disheveled, man of the street. So they were, again, kind of perfect comedic foil for Darren McGavin's Carl Kolchak.
And then there was the elderly puzzle and advice columnist known as Miss Emily, played by Ruth McDevitt, and her character, Emily Cowles, which was kind of a warm and endearing relationship because she often actually sympathized with Kolchak.
She did. She was sort of the grandmotherly figure, although had her own quirks. She was writing a romance novel. She did in one episode talk about octogenarian sex. So clearly there was more than meets the eye with Miss Emily. But there's actually a wonderful episode where a mystical creature appears to its victims as someone they trust. And when it at the end appears to Carl Kolchak trying to get him off his guard, the mystical creature appears as Miss Emily. So clearly of all the cast, Miss Emily was the one person that Carl trusted. But she was a great comedic foil to kind of push the plot forward and offer a little bit of comedy relief in between the creatures and the features.
All right. So the decision to take the character and what they laid out in the movies of the week, The Night Stalker and then The Night Strangler, and turn that into a TV series on ABC in the fall of 74. How did that come about?
Well, it's interesting because Dan Curtis, who had, again, produced the first two TV movies, The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler, and he had actually directed the second TV movie, he and Richard Matheson were hard at work on a third TV movie, and ABC kind of unceremoniously pulled it out from underneath him. I think ABC felt that they needed to add to their lineup, and so that Friday lineup already had the Bionic Man as a kind of anchor, and so I think ABC at the time thought they really wanted to try to capture that science fiction fantasy market, and thought that the combination of the Bionic Man, the $6 million man, and the Night Stalker would be a winner for them. Spoiler alert, it was actually not a winner for them, but that was sort of the gamble.
And was McGavin, was he eager to do the series? Was he somewhat reluctant?
McGavin was eager. I think he saw a lot of potential in the character. I think he had a lot of hopes that the series could develop. He would later become frustrated with the way the series kind of fell into a kind of monster of the week, so that each week there was a new creature and Carl defeats it, and then the next week there's another creature. But initially, you know, McGavin had spent most of his early career in television, and the prospect of being able to play Carl in a stable series format really appealed to him until it began to become a bit stale.
All right. So, well, I'll tell you what, we'll take another time out. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the 20 episodes on The Night Stalker, again on ABC from September 1974 until March of 75. Kendall R. Phillips is with us. And again, his new book, Kolchak, The Night Stalker, part of TV Milestones series. And we'll get into some of our favorite episodes. Don't go away.
It's time to redefine reality. Reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we are back with Kendall R. Phillips. And Kendall, we should talk a little bit about Pop Life, the podcast. How do we listen? What's it about?
Yeah, thanks. So Pop Life is a podcast produced WAER. It's released through National Public Radio here in the United States and anywhere else in the world. And basically, Pop Life are interviews that I conduct with creative leaders. So we've had directors from the Sundance Institute. We've had folks from Disney Studios. We've had leading academics and critics and best-selling authors. And I suppose our goal in Pop Life is to kind of dig under the surface. So not just talk to celebrities about what they're doing, but to dig under the surface and kind of ask, why are these things trending and why are they popular? So feel free to log on if that sounds interesting to WAER.org. And you can find us right there on the radio station website.
All right. So the series... 20 episodes. I believe the first episode was the called The Ripper, which is a take on Jack the Ripper. Kolchak is trying to convince people that the serial killer that's running loose is actually Jack the Ripper. That debuted in September of 1974. Thoughts on that premiere episode?
Well, what I think is interesting about that episode, and really the first three or four episodes, are they retain a little bit of that kind of darker element of the TV movie. So the two TV movies are, as much as they're made for television, and so they're not super violent or super lewd or obscene, they have a definite harsh tone. They're closer to the kinds of horror movies that were happening in the 1970s in movie theaters than they were to television. And those first couple of episodes, especially The Ripper and the second episode, The Zombie, kind of keep a little bit of that brutal, a little bit more gruesome, a little bit more violent. And after those, the series starts to kind of become a little bit lighter as ABC is trying to find an audience, probably trying to appeal to younger people. But The Ripper certainly could have easily also been like the TV movies. It is a dark, a lot of it's set in strip clubs. The beginning of the investigation is actually our friend Miss Emily, who gets the Dear Lovelorn letters for the newspaper, and that's what eventually leads Carl to finding out that this mysterious serial killer in Chicago is none other than the immortal Jack the Ripper.
One of the more interesting episode titles: "They Have Been, They Are, They Will Be." This is also known as UFO. And so you have this, it's an invisible alien, and it's sucking out the bone marrow of its victims while it's making repairs on its ship and, looking for directions home. Your thoughts on that episode?
I mean, talk about, so there's nothing more creative than television producers on a limited budget. So undoubtedly having an invisible alien is the best way to avoid the excessive special effects cost of having a real alien. But clearly, America in the early 1970s is UFO obsessed. And so having an episode focused on UFOs makes perfect sense. My favorite little bit of trivia in that episode is that at one point, Carl is listening to the radio, a fictional World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the Boston
yeah,
Red Sox.
Yeah, that was fiction.
Did not happen. But certainly somebody was trying to throw a bone to both Boston and Chicago. I'm not sure if it helped the ratings, but it's probably the most fantastic element of all of the Night Stalker series.
That's right. Keeping in mind, in 1974, the Chicago Cubs had not won a World Series since 1908, the year that Leo Tolstoy died. And, of course, the Boston Red Sox were still languishing under the curse of Babe Ruth. They hadn't won one since 1918. Of course, they've both... I guess vindicated themselves since. The other interesting that the this is a nice little Easter egg in that episode, because the person who's calling that World Series game on the radio is none other than legendary sportscaster Dick Enberg.
That's right. That's right. So it adds a degree of authenticity to something. So maybe, really Kolchak was just prescient. He was prophetic to see what would eventually happen for both the Cubs and the Red Sox.
But there you go.
Undoubtedly, that's one of those episodes. The other episode I really love from that period is The Zombie, which is the second episode, if I could just mention that one. Because
yes.
I honestly think The Zombie is probably one of the actually scariest of the movies. Here we have a Haitian zombie who's being used in a gang war between kind of an Italian mafia-style crime syndicate and a more blaxploitation sort of African-American crime syndicate. And this zombie is quite terrifying. And there's a particularly chilling scene where Carl is going to try to subdue the zombie, which requires him to sew the zombie's mouth shut after having filled it with salt. And you can just imagine how that goes wrong. But I recommend, if anybody wants an episode of Cold Shack to get a feel for how the show could be genuinely scary, I think that's probably the best episode.
Oh, you're so right. Yes, he has to climb into the back of that hearse, I don't know. It's in a wrecking yard, I think, abandoned automobile. The zombie, absolutely. My favorite episode, because I guess I was a glutton for punishment, not having been traumatized enough by the movie of the week with the Night Stalker. The Vampire, which is kind of a sequel to that first movie. Tell me about The Vampire. This time it's a female vampire.
It's interesting that it is sort of a sequel, although ABC did not retain the rights to the original TV movie. So they couldn't actually talk about Janos Skorzeny. They couldn't talk about the events of the first movie. So they had to just have a female victim of a vampire being released in Las Vegas and then heading to California to find her family. And then, of course, bad things ensue. For those who had seen the original TV movie, of course, it doesn't take too much to connect the dots. But there's actually no explicit mention of the original vampire. But it is another very chilling episode. There's some really terrifying scenes as Carl confronts the female vampire at the end. So again, those first three or four episodes really hold on to the kind of more frightening elements of the TV movies. That, of course, starts to fade out as the series goes on.
Yeah. In fact, I think, the very next episode after The Vampire, we played a clip coming back from the break a little while ago, The Werewolf. I don't know. To me, this is, it's an overused expression, but where maybe the series jumped the shark. What are your thoughts on The Werewolf?
Yeah, I think by this point, it's clear that the writers are not settling into any kind of bigger story, even though one of the writers for that show was David Chase, who would go on to, of course, a huge success with The Sopranos. It becomes clear they're kind of just looking for something to do. And so the idea of putting a werewolf on a cruise ship, that's a fascinating concept, but doesn't really play out. You also, after that episode, start finding them, I would say, stretching a little bit to find new creatures. And I think this is part of what the series runs into as a problem, is they don't seem to want to repeat. So Carl never re-encounters another vampire or another werewolf or another zombie or anything. Every episode has to be some new creation. And so eventually you're really starting to work your way down the bench of monsters as you're trying to find something to fill in episode 18, 19, and 20.
Right. Although I thought they maybe vindicated themselves or a little bit later in the series with Bad Medicine, which is this Native American legend, and there's a shaman spirit called the Diablero, played by Richard Kiel, which, of course, he often played Native Americans and Westerns and so forth. People will remember him as Lurch from the original Adams family series.
And Jaws from the James Bond series. No, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about that desperate search for more creatures is it pushes, and this is probably one of the good things about the series, it pushes them out of that traditional European tradition of monsters. And so you end up with the shaman in Bad Medicine. You end up with an ancient Native American god in The Energy Eater, which is actually one of my favorite episodes. You get them starting to go into like Creole traditions and the Spanish moss murders. They go into Aztec traditions, witchcraft. So they get very creative, but at some point it starts to just kind of feel like, again, Monster of the Week. It's Friday night. What new monster will Carl face?
So was the series canceled, or did Darren McGavin just said, I had enough?
Both. So it's absolutely true that Darren McGavin got very tired of the series. Not only was it not really developing a through line of a story, it was not really developing the characters at all. Carl was always just kind of the same person going through the motions. There were also a lot of problems with the production. It was cheap. The budget was low. He was endlessly complaining that script writers were bringing in pages on the day. So nobody was prepared. No one knew what was going on. And again, he was very professional and he really wanted a tighter run set. But it's also absolutely the case that the TV series, Kolchak the Night Stalker, never found its audience. And in fact, at the end of that season, I think, if I'm remembering right, it ranked down as tied for number 65. And this is back in the day when there were not that many TV shows, because really only the major three networks. It was number 65, tied with the Sonny Bono show. This is not Sonny and Cher. This is post-divorce Sonny's own variety show that also never found its audience. So ABC canceled the series, but McGavin was tired. There were actually three scripts that were never produced. It just never came together as well as the TV movie.
It's such a great character and a great premise, and I know they brought it back in 2005 with Stuart Townsend playing the Kolchak character. Didn't do very well, but it also spawned a comic book series from Moonstone, right?
Yeah, so Moonstone has really been the place for Kolchak fans. They've published a number of novels, many of which are very, very good, that have continued finding new foes for Carl. The comic books have been great. I know there's a 50th anniversary, and that's, you know, the original TV movie is 1972, so we're in the 50th anniversary of Carl's kind of emergence into pop culture imagination. So Moonstone's done a great job. The fans, and I really need a shout out to the true Kolchak fans. They are just so rabid and passionate, and they're always thinking of new ways that Carl could have faced Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees, or what Carl would have done in the X-Files. They're also always recreating scenes and trying to track down the exact right straw hat and the exact right brand of shoes. So there's an enormous amount of love for Carl that I do think, you know, and I think I mentioned this earlier, I think a lot of that love comes from the re-airings of the show starting in 1979 on CBS. So CBS late night decided to stop trying to compete with The Tonight Show, and CBS just started sort of dumping reruns of strange shows. That's where I first saw Barnaby Jones. It's where I first saw the British show The Avengers and The New Avengers. And that's, for me as a little bit younger person, that's where I first saw The Night Stalker. And so I think a lot of folks who would not have ever heard of Carl saw The Night Stalker in those 1979, 1980 reruns on CBS late night. And I think that really helped to foster this enormous cult classic love of the series.
About 10 years ago, Disney announced that there was some kind of a film adaptation in the works. I think Johnny Depp was slated to star as Carl Kolchak. Did that ever, whatever happened with that?
So that Edgar Wright, who directed Baby Driver and a number of other very successful shows or films, was going to make it. Johnny Depp was attached. I think what happened, although I've never actually seen this written, about a year before that was to go into production, Tim Burton decided to try to remake Dark Shadows, the original soap opera, in a movie using Johnny Depp in the role of Barnabas Collins. The movie, for anyone who was unfortunate enough to see it, was a disaster. It was a box office disaster. And I think that failure of Johnny Depp and a 1970s Dan Curtis product to find an audience pretty much put the end to any plans of rebooting Carl Kolchak. But I think, you know, the reality is, for most of us who really love the series, it's hard to imagine anybody else as Carl Kolchak. Stuart Townsend is a very good actor. He's too good looking to be Carl. He's not funny enough. Johnny Depp is a fine actor. I just don't know that anybody who loved the series is going to be able to see any other human being in that seersucker suit except Darren McGavin.
All right. Well, we have something else to look forward to, and that is Kolchak the Night Stalker. That's part of the TV Milestone series, and that is available this month through Amazon. And where else can we get it, Kendall?
They can get it from the publisher, which is Wayne State University Press, and probably anywhere else books are sold, if there are still places where books are sold. Again, I would say if you love Kolchak, I hope you'll look at the book. But I would say to anybody listening, if you just love horror television, if you love Walking Dead or Discovery of Witches or Buffy or The X-Files, all of those series owe their existence to this little 1972 TV movie and this little TV series. And it really deserves the credit. And for me, writing the book was really about saying Carl Kolchak should be recognized as a TV milestone.
Absolutely. And of course, there is the podcast Pop Life, Feeding the Curious Pop Culture Mind. How do we listen, Kendall?
Again, if you go into, we're on all the major platforms, so Spotify, Apple, iHeart. If you want to go directly, you can get us either through WAER.org or National Public Radio, NPR.org. Feel free, log in and give us a listen.
Wow, what a delight speaking with you, and a trip down memory lane talking about one of my favorite TV shows, The Night Stalker, and one of my favorite characters, Carl Kolchak. Kendall, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Richard. It's been an honor to be with you.
A new Richard Serrett's A Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.